Good morning. Good to see everyone again. Well, I'm sure you've all had busy weeks, and I had a really busy weekend. I had the privilege of going out to my school this weekend. I'm doing a weekend intensive, they call it. So during the entirety of my schooling, while I do a lot of it online, the restrictions of it are that in order to have full accreditation, you have to have that part of your schooling be on campus itself. And so in order to fulfill those requirements, I have to make a certain amount of pilgrimages out there and spend some time on campus doing schooling. So this past weekend is what's called a weekend intensive. So I will go out for this past weekend was the first weekend this semester. Then I'll go out for another weekend in October, then on through December. So it was interesting because one of the classes that I'm required to take isn't a class that I would have necessarily picked myself, but it was recommended to me through a professor that I have a lot of respect for. But it was on science fiction, and so I'm sure there's some science fiction fans in the crowd. It's not actually about science fiction. It uses science fiction and it brings the theology that's inherent in science fiction out, which I would have never put those two together ever. But apparently there's something to it. So as I'm sitting in class and we're talking about these things and looking, I had spent the last month or so watching clips and reading a lot of material that pertains to this science fiction. And finding about, you know, what's behind it. Why do we see the world the way we do? And it's interesting that why do we as people like movies in general? Or books. It doesn't even have to be movies. Magazines. Comic books. Whatever it is. What is it that drives us to these things? And I hate to keep hitting the same point, but it's because we inherently love stories so much. We love stories. And the further question is, why do we love stories so much? What's the root cause of it? And I think, I'm not saying there's necessarily just one answer, but I think it's because in the stories that we absorb, a lot of times we see ourselves in those stories. And so as I was kind of thinking about this, I thought, you know, a good way to describe it is that sometimes we find ourselves in a story. But yet, sometimes in stories, we find ourselves. And what I mean by that is, sometimes we find ourselves immersed in someone else's story or another story, but in those stories, we see ourselves. And we find out what it is that we long for, what it is that we desire, what our worldview is really like. How do we see the world? And so those things come into it. Now, I want to take that one step further and look at today's body of text. And our body of text today is chapter 11, verse 19, through chapter 12, verse 25. And this is kind of one unit. While we're going to have multiple scenes again today, it's really one unit from beginning to end. But in this text, we have these stories being told. Now, I want you to think about this in the stories as we go through these one by one. And I want you to think about the emphasis of the story. And think about, what if you were there? What if this is part of your story? What if you're not just an external viewer, but what if the story were to ask you to interact? What would it look like? Think about our world today with the chaos that we're the trouble that's in the world, the hurricanes that are present, Houston, all these things that we see from day to day and that are being wrestled with as we speak. Think about the story and how it impacts you. And I want you to also think about the story as not just this story, but the stories of the Bible. I want you to think about reading those stories and saying, there's something that can speak to my story in this. So it's not just about me bringing out really neat points out of this particular story. It's about you looking at the story. And when we're able to dissect the story and look at it as it is, as its storyteller intended it to be, it can speak to you in a way that I could never, or anyone else could never, because it's only you who know those certain parts of your story that it really puts its finger on. And so in being able to tell the story this way, it allows to draw the readers in. And so that's what I really hope that can be, your story can collide with this story in multiple ways. So I've chosen the title for this morning, Antioch joins Jerusalem. And as you've seen, my titles have included Jerusalem a lot, and I have done that intentionally because I wanted to draw the emphasis on Jerusalem as it's continued to be. Now, I wanted to bring in Antioch because Antioch comes into the story in a new way, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But Antioch joins Jerusalem, and Antioch joins Jerusalem in what? Okay? So, starting in verse 19, we find Antioch joining Jerusalem as this main hub for mission. And Jerusalem will still retain its symbolic role throughout the story and throughout the entirety of Acts, actually. But in the first scene that we find is kind of a relief mission. And again, think about things that are happening today and how the church addresses those things. But the story begins with a flashback to the end of Stephen's story. Remember the Stephen story in chapter 7? Stephen was martyred. In chapter 8, verse 1, right after Stephen's death, the text says that severe persecution began against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered. So you still had a core group of apostles in Jerusalem, but many of those believers were scattered. Now, as we come into this text, we're kind of picking up that story. And we've seen that happen before with Acts. It's how he'll tell a bunch of stories, and then he'll go back in time a little bit and finish telling another story that he'd begun. So he interweaves his characters back and forth. Okay? So our text today, verse 19 of chapter 11, says, "Now those who were scattered because of the persecution that took place over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch." Now, I'm going to put this map up here so you can kind of see a little bit of what we're talking about. See Jerusalem down at the bottom there, and Phoenicia right above Jerusalem. And then Cyprus is the island off to the left. Antioch is not quite to the top on the right. And then Tarsus, you'll hear Tarsus come up. That's at the top. And then Cilicia is kind of a large body, not one specific city, but kind of a group, a territory, if you want to call it that. So that's kind of the landscape of what we're talking about, the stories taking place in this area. Now, this is the specific Antioch we're speaking of. There's two Antiochs. There's one in Antioch of Pisidia, and it's kind of off our map. But that's a different Antioch. This is the one that's in Syria. It was Paul's going to actually travel there in chapter 13, but that's ahead of us. The city of Antioch was a thriving metropolis, and it had about 500,000 people that lived there. It was actually the third largest city in the Roman Empire. And particularly what I want to draw your attention to is that Antioch was an important city because it was kind of the crossroads of culture. It was a massively important city, so it had people in and out all the time. So it was right smack in the middle of where civilization was happening. You couldn't be any more mainstream. It's New York City. It's a big-time city, okay? So this isn't just some small, obscure town that's off the beaten path. No, this is right smack in the middle of today, okay? Like pretty much every major Roman city, it was known for its moral depletion. They had some moral problems. But now, with the disciples coming, and the travelers that are being dispersed, they have a new message that is hitting their ears. Eventually, this city will become the capital of the Gentile mission. The mission to the Gentiles will have its core root in Antioch. And this is where most of Paul's missionary journeys will also begin and end. Now, there were some that were there who were from the other towns, the other territories, Cyprus and Cyrene in the first place. So they arrived in Antioch and began preaching this good news, this message, this life-giving message to the Hellenists. Now, remember, our writer has already told us something about the Hellenists. The Hellenists were the group that Stephen and the other six deacons came from. They were the ones who Paul argued with when he went back. They were the ones who wanted to kill him. That was in chapter 9. We read that. But Luke isn't too specific here. But some of these individuals, the ones from Cyprus and Cyrene, particularly in northern Africa, they had to break across religious and ethnic lines when they had to come and reach a large population of Greeks in Antioch. They didn't necessarily match that well. You had conflict. Okay? So how do they address this conflict? The story continues. Because the Lord's hand was with them, many believed and turned to the Lord. So here we have our narrator continuing to tell us, God's still moving. It's still happening. His hand's strong with them. Now, our character that was introduced earlier, Barnabas, you remember him? He was a Levite from Cyprus. Island there? His name, remember, it was actually Joseph, but he was given the name Barnabas, which we're told means son of encouragement or encourager, and we read that in chapter 4. The last time we heard of him was when he had stood up for Saul in Jerusalem and it had brought him to the apostles, and he had told Saul's story to the other disciples so that he could be accepted among them. Now, the news of this reaches Jerusalem. What's happening in Antioch reaches Jerusalem. So what the disciples in Jerusalem, the apostles do, is they send those who are in Jerusalem to Antioch. Now it's kind of the opposite. They're going from Jerusalem into Antioch, probably as an emissary to represent the presence of the Jerusalem leadership. So like as an emissary or a sent one, that's what the word apostle actually means. So, true to character, Barnabas is encouraging and staying loyal to the Lord with all their hearts. He encourages them to just press on, continue on. So this is part of who Barnabas has been known to be. The writer also adds that he was a good man who was full of the Holy Spirit and of faith. Now, again, the writer informs us that a substantial crowd, was added to the Lord. Barnabas then went to Tarsus. Now that's clear up at the north that you see there on the screen. So he goes up to Tarsus. If you remember, Saul had gone to Tarsus. So now Barnabas is going looking for Saul. And he brings him back to Antioch. So they stay in Antioch for a whole year. They received reception and hospitality from the people there. And they continued to teach a substantial crowd as they continued to be there. And then we're told that here in Antioch was the first time that the followers of Jesus were called Christians. Now, I want to step out of the story for just a moment to talk about this, because it's important to us, because we all would classify ourselves as Christians. We have this namesake. So I just want to touch on a little bit on what this meant to them. There are multiple, just to let you know, there are multiple views as to what this actually means. Nobody can be completely certain. But there are, I'm going to give you just a couple tidbits on it. But more than likely, it started off as a nickname. And the reason we think that is because there were lots of beliefs going around that time. When scholars talk about Christianity, they don't talk about Christianity. They talk about Christianities, because there were lots of views that were happening. Many views, radically different views. When scholars talk about Judaism, they don't talk about Judaism. They talk about Judaisms, because there were lots of different views within Judaism. You had the Pharisees, but on the one side you had the Hillel Pharisees, and they were charismatic and crazy people. Then on the other side you had Shammai Pharisees. Well, they were pretty staunch and conservative. So you have all these different... Then you have the Sadducees, and they're completely different. So you have all these differing views. In the same way as Christianity emerged, we had lots of different views present there. So, but it probably started off as a nickname to mark the distinction between these Jews who believe, well, like we've always believed, and then these Jews who believe in this new charismatic fellow named Jesus of Nazareth, who some are calling the Christ. And in Greek, that word is Christos or Christos. And what it really means is, if you have that terminology of Christian, it means of the party of Christ. So it's really an interpretation, because you're saying, we believe the Christ has come, we believe this one is the Christ, and so we're of the party of this Christ. There were others who were doing the same thing. Those who were of Caesar's party, were called Caesareans. Those who were of the party of Herod were called Herodians. Those who were the party of Pompey were called Pompeians. So this was a very common thing that was done. So they took on this party of. We are the party of Christ. We belong to the party of the Christ. Now, I want to give you a couple points of contemplation before we step back into our story. The one is of terminology and meaning. When we talk about Christian today, it's a term that's loaded. A lot of times politically, for us, the word Christian has lost a lot of meaning because we've heard it so much. But if you would, just think about what we're saying when we say the word Christian. If you belong to the party of Christ, that means you represent. You are one who is affiliated with what the Christ is affiliated. What the Christ taught. What did Jesus teach? What were his teachings? Those things we find in the Gospels. And so it disturbs me to no end when we see a lot of Christians who are being very un-Christ-like. They are claiming to be of the party that doesn't represent what Jesus represented at all. But yet they still take the title. It'd be like if I claim to be a Republican, but yet everything I believe in is more along the lines of the Communist Party. Well, what good is it to call yourself a Republican if you're believing everything that the Communist Party dictates? No pun intended. You understand what I'm saying? It's a difference of terminology. And so think about it whenever you use that word. What is it that you're actually saying or describing or affiliating yourself with? And another one is this idea of being on the crossroads of the culture. And I'll hit this just in a little bit later. But Antioch, right smack in the middle of where culture was happening. And this is where they start, where they begin, where the Gentile mission gets its foothold, and where Jerusalem sends its people. A lot of times I think we as Christians can think that that the best thing to do is to go hide in the corner and try to shield ourselves from all the evil of the world. That's not the story we find here. The story we find here is they're going right into the middle of where the battle is happening, where culture is happening, and they're being the light on the hill. They're being the beacon of hope, rather than going and hiding somewhere and hoping that I don't get affected. Actually, Jesus said something very similar when he was at Caesarea Philippi. He told his disciples that the gates of hell would not prevail against them. The idea of the gates of hell not prevailing isn't the idea of being on defense and hoping your gates hold. The idea of this what Jesus is saying here, is that the gates of hell, meaning we are on the offense, the gates of hell will not keep us out. Meaning they don't stand a chance because this message has God behind it. That's the point of the whole thing. So I don't like to see Christians take the idea of cowering and running and hiding. Although in certain instances, and we find this in the early church, when there's persecution, sometimes that's the best thing to do. But it has nothing to do with running because of the message. It has to do with protecting family, friends, etc. from the physical persecution that's happening. Not because we're scared the culture might rub off on us. That's an entirely different point. Does that make sense? Good, I can tell from your face I got through. Okay, so back to our story. Israel's central location, as where the people of God were located, was on a major highway. You see there, that's the sea there, is the Mediterranean Sea. Okay, Israel was located right in the middle of the highway. So to connect the north to the south, you had to go through Israel. God placed his people right smack in the middle of the highway, if you want to put it that way. Okay? And so the Spirit is leading these people into the central hubs of world culture, not sending them off to cower and hide somewhere, but rather he wanted his message to reach where culture was happening and people were being shaped. So back into our verse 27 of chapter 11, prophets then started to pop up in Antioch, we're told. Agabus was one who stood up and gave indication that the whole world, in their definition of whole world here, is a little bit different than our definition of whole world. They didn't necessarily have the idea of a globe and a multi-continental world like we do. Their whole world was encompassed in the Roman Empire. And so for them, that's what they're speaking of. The entire region was falling under this famine. The writer tells us, puts a little footnote in there, that this famine was happening during the reign of an emperor named Claudius. Now, we know from other sources that during this period of time, in 46 AD, that there were high grain prices. And there was actually a grain shortage also in Rome in 51 AD. The emperor, actually it was so bad, the emperor Claudius was mobbed in the streets. Now, with this idea of sending aid that we find in the text here, it's important to note that when the disciples, the Christians that are in Antioch, decide to send relief to Jerusalem, to Judea for this, that they're performing an invaluable service by supporting order. Just like I mentioned about Claudius being mobbed in the streets. Famine was a major source of riots. So this is something that's going to help keep order, not just a matter of relief for the individuals, but keeping order for the region because of the social upheaval that could possibly take place. But also I want you to think about, Antioch was also going to be affected by this famine. And so by these disciples, these apostles, these followers of Jesus, by them sending aid, they're also having self-sacrifice here. Because by sending something to someone else, it means they won't have that. And so this is an act of self-sacrifice for them. So we have this idea of cross-cultural aid, sending relief abroad. The church that was somewhere was going to help the church somewhere else. These disciples had made up their mind that they were going to be able to do, they were going to do what they could to help their sisters and brothers in Judea. And so this is another point where I want to stop and give us a little bit of reflection, particularly what's happening right now as we speak. We have brothers and sisters all over the world, and Eldina mentioned this morning. I appreciate that. There is tragedy and there is heartbreak and suffering happening everywhere. And I don't want us to ever underestimate the importance of being able to reach out in the way. Sometimes we're limited as to what we can do, and there's just not much. But I am so thankful for those who feel it their mission and their God-driven call to help drive these missions, to help others, not necessarily in their own location. We have tragedy having struck in Houston. Florida's getting hit right now. So what's amazing, though, even in the stories that surfaced after Houston, we find that adversity a lot of times can bring people together. And I think that's a beautiful thing. It's not that we like adversity, but it can be used by God to strengthen His community. For that one brief moment, we can forget ourselves. Unfortunately, why does it take hardship and disaster and tragedy for us to do this? Wouldn't it be a beautiful thing if we just live perpetually like this, forgetting ourselves and putting others before us and living as if there was a tragedy every day? Now, I'm not inviting tragedy every day, but in Houston, I saw so many reports of, a lot of the dissension and all of the fighting and everything, it just disappeared for a time. It was just gone. And I think that's amazing that people can band together like that in the face of adversity. So Barnabas and Saul are teamed up as envoys from Antioch, and they bear a gift. They're sent with a gift to Jerusalem from Antioch. Then we come to the scene two. And this runs from verse 1 of chapter 12 through verse 19. So it's around this same time then that Herod, and his name is called Agrippa the First, he begins to persecute some in the church. And he killed the disciple James, who was John's brother. You know, Peter, James, and John have a little sailboat, that guy. So Agrippa the First, Herod, he lived in Jerusalem. He arrests Peter. When Herod tended to like to please people, so he saw that it pleased certain people, so he had Peter arrested also. Now this event of Peter's arrest was happening around the time of Passover. What else happened at this time? Who else was arrested around Passover? Jesus, exactly. So you have kind of the same story happening, and this is a pattern that our writer likes to do, is to show how his followers are just like the master. And so Peter is also arrested and put in prison around this time. And why did Herod do this? We're not sure exactly why. I mean, for the trying to please the people. But Herod also loved entertainment. So having somebody like Peter arrested at this time was a lot of drama and entertainment for the people. So, I mean, sometimes he even executed people just for the sake of public entertainment. And it was part of his way to please people. Josephus, the historian, tells us this. But it also served as a warning to others. Be careful where you step. I still hold the power in this region. So Peter is locked up, and he's given four squads. Now this means that there's four soldiers on four shifts that are guarding Peter. They're not taking any chances. So Peter is most likely imprisoned in Jerusalem. There was a fort there, a Roman fort called Fort Antonia. It was in the upper city, and it was most likely the place with the most Roman soldiers, because we know there was a cohort that was stationed there. If you remember, I told you last time, a cohort was roughly 480 to 600 soldiers. So this is a problem for the church. This is a tragedy for the church, if the text doesn't jump out to you, because you have James, who's a leader, one of the disciples, one of the core group of Jesus, he's beheaded. Now Peter, another major leader in the church, is locked up. What are the people to think? What are they to do? Not that they can't function without these guys, but these guys are major influence in their community, in the movement, because that it's their connection a lot to Jesus still, teaching what Jesus had taught them. Now, if you remember back with me in chapter 5, this was the last time that Peter was locked up, and he was released by an angel. This is the second of three prison breaks that we'll find in the book of Acts. And they seem to occur, and probably intentionally so, they seem to occur around the time that important elements of the church are taking place. So the intention of Herod was to keep him locked up until after Passover. So now we have the church. They're gathered together, and they're earnestly praying for him. This is where the story gets really interesting. I want you to take a mental note that they're earnestly praying. Okay? They're fervently praying for Peter. So Peter's bound by two chains, with two soldiers, and there's guards at the door. An angel of the Lord comes in, and there's a light that shines, and he comes over to Peter, kicks him in the side, or hits him in the side, doesn't tell us exactly which appendage that was used, but he tells Peter, get up, get your cloak, we're leaving. Peter's chains fall off, and he followed the angel. He didn't actually think that what was taking place was actually taking place. He thought it was a vision that was happening. So they go out past the first set of guards, then they go past the second set of guards, and then they come to the iron gate, which led to the city itself, and the iron gate opened by itself. Of course, today we wouldn't think anything about that. Gates, of course, open by themselves. Crazy. So they're walking along the street, and the angel departs. Peter's alone, walking on the street at night. Now we come to verse 11, and Peter says, now I know it's true. Now I know that what I'm seeing is real. The Lord has sent his angel and has rescued me, basically. Now, that's the second thing I want to draw your attention to. The Lord has sent his angel. Okay, you remember that? Good. So he's rescued from what the Judeans had attempted to do, what Herod had attempted to do. Peter's rescued by direct intervention of God through his angel. So he went to the house of Mary, who is the mother of John Mark. And this is an introduction to a new character, John Mark, that we'll find. And so there they are praying. They're praying in the home. This wasn't unusual for the early church. For the first 3 centuries of the church, meeting in homes was the regular. Buildings didn't come in until at least the 3rd century. Same synagogues kind of had a similar line. So this is Jerusalem. Remember what's happened in Jerusalem. Passover, Jesus' resurrection. In Jerusalem, the early church, these early believers, the assembly who believes in Jesus as the Messiah. They've seen some amazing things happen. Miracles, the resurrection of Jesus. They've seen some remarkable things take place. But it's interesting their response as we get into the story. Their response is that they're not expecting anything from their prayer. Now, does that strike you as odd? That they're praying fervently, but yet they don't expect anything in response to their prayer. So here you have Peter. He comes to the gate of this house as a direct response to their prayers. Okay? And then there's a maid named Rhoda, whose name means rose. So Rose comes to the door. She's so excited to hear Peter. She's really excited to hear the voice of him at the front door that she forgets to open the front door. Now, this is intentionally humorous. So she leaves Peter there, and she runs to the others. It's Peter! It's Peter! And, of course, they're all so full of faith, and they're all so trusting in God that they tell her, you're insane, right? Isn't that the response that we have to God's miraculous working power? You're insane. Of course God can do it. You're insane, woman. That it just strikes me really funny that that's their response when they're praying so fervently and they've seen so many things take place and so full of faith. But then she insists that she's seen it. But they say, no, you've misinterpreted his voice. If it's Peter's voice, don't worry. He's probably already dead. And he's just calling to you from the grave. The irony is having the prayer meeting and not expecting it to do any good. Luke 24, at Jesus' resurrection, if you remember at the tomb, what was there? Disbelief. The exact same thing. Disbelief right to a risen Jesus, no less. And so this is another one where I want to step outside the story for just a moment and give a slight reflection. To me, this is actually somewhat comforting. I might know that might sound a little bit odd, but the storyteller is trying to give us a portrait of this early group of believers. And for a moment, we don't see them as a bunch of heroes and heroines of the faith. We see them for this little glimpse as real people, the same kind of muddled, half-believing, mountaintop to deep valley sorts of folks that we all know and that we all represent. They have the same struggles we do. Of course they struggle with disbelief and doubt. They're people. And so I love this part of the story, actually, because it's so real to what we all know. So, back in the story. Meanwhile, Peter, still knocking at the gate. They come to the gate finally, and Peter's first thing is, quiet. And he tells them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. Now, this is where I wanted to check that mental note that I had given you about the angel. It said, Peter said, the angel of the Lord has let me out. Well, here, Peter doesn't say the angel of the Lord let me out. He says, the Lord let me out. So Peter, within just a little bit of text, says it was the Lord who let him out and the angel of the Lord who let him out. And so this is what I've been trying to tell you through Acts briefly, is the importance that's often stressed, even subconsciously, by the narrator of agency. God is constantly partnering, not only with humans, but even with angelic beings, to fulfill his goals and his purposes. And so it doesn't matter whether it was Peter taking the message, God spoke. It doesn't matter if the angel was the one who opened the door, God let him out. It's God working in and through people. And that's an important thing I want to tie at the end. Okay? So remember that for the next little bit here. So he stops them and tells them, I want you to tell James, and this isn't the James that was beheaded, of course. This is the Lord's brother, James. I want you to tell James and the brothers and sisters about what has happened. And then he took off, it says. Now, we were just now introduced to John Mark, just a moment ago, whose mother, the house was where it was taking place. And now we're introduced to a new character, James. And James will come into the story later, too. This is where we're introduced. James has become the leader in Jerusalem. Presumably, he's become the leader because Peter, for one, isn't present. But also, it's possible that James has now taken the major role in Jerusalem because of the difficulties that has surrounded Peter. If you remember last week, we talked about the difficulties that Jerusalem had in accepting what Peter had done. Peter had eaten with the uncircumcised, and he's accepted the Gentiles. Well, while some Jews accepted this, this was still taboo for others. We can't go there. And so this might have been what excluded Peter from being the head of the Jerusalem assembly. Okay, we don't know that for certain, but a lot of commentators seem to think this is probably the most the easiest explanation and explains mostly what's happening here. So Peter is also a hunted man. We see this. He's constantly going to prison. James, however, is not. So what we find in this story is that Peter's most significant role has now come to a close. This is the end of Peter. Now, we're not saying Peter dies here. We do find him having a slight interaction in chapter 15. But this is the end of Peter's story, as the writer of Acts tells it. And it's interesting that the words that are in your text, it says he was going elsewhere, or it means literally go to a place. Now, the last time this was used, the last time this phrase was used in the book of Acts was by Peter himself when he described where Judas was going. Judas was going to a place. Now, again, it's just a subtle hint. We don't really know. It is also interesting that shortly after this, there's a book that's not in the Bible, but it is written around the same time period, written by a man named Clement. The book is called First Clement. But he talks about Peter, and he uses the exact same phrase regarding Peter's death. And he says, "Thus, having given his testimony," meaning Peter having given his testimony, "he went to his appointed place of glory." So, again, we don't know, but we have this connection of three times. So, I'm just giving you that. You can consider that however you like. So then the next morning, the guards were interrogated because of the whereabouts of Peter. Really? We had how many soldiers guarding this guy? And you can't keep him in? This time, the guards don't fare so well. They're put to death at the hand of Herod. Then we're told that Herod, or Agrippa I, he left Jerusalem, and headed to Caesarea. Then we come to scene 3. I showed you some Caesarea stuff last time. Now what we're talking about is in verse 20 through 23. Now, this is where Caesarea is in relation to Tyre and Sidon, the two that are spoken of in this text. Herod was angry with these people that were in Tyre and Sidon. And these people, they're dependent. They didn't have their own food supply. They were dependent on the import of grain from Judea. And Herod had been holding them back. And so they found themselves in a place where they were going to have to really smooth talk Herod. Because, well, we need food. And remember, there's a famine that's possibly happening right now. Now, a couple things about Herod. According to various sources, Herod Agrippa, this Herod, died in 44 AD. He ruled over a significant part of this land that you see here, almost as much as his grandfather, Herod the Great. Herod the Great is the one who had built amazing works, like the Second Temple is the one that he had done. A lot of the things that are in Jerusalem and in the region today are works that Herod had built. Even Caesarea was one of his works. So, but he was a butcher, like his grandfather, meaning killing was his specialty. He enjoyed it. He would inflict pain just for the sake of it. And he had a lot of pride. He loved to flaunt his power. Now, this is the Caesarean Theater. It's built on the ruins of the one that was in existence that Herod the Great had built, who was Agrippa's grandfather. So this is where, more than likely, where he is at this theater. Josephus tells us that he was at this theater. And the irony in this part is that Peter was captured by Agrippa, by Herod, and he was he escaped from Herod's hand. Whereas Agrippa comes to a really, really awful ending in this story. Josephus, the historian, describes it for us. He says, He gives a very vivid description of of Agrippa. But he says that at this time, Agrippa was arrayed in this gorgeous silver robe, and it was designed to catch the light of the rising sun and give the effect that he himself was shining as if he were a supernatural being, as if he were a god, a deity. And so whenever everybody saw it, they lifted their voices and said, "Oh, this is not the voice of a man, but of a deity, of a god." The word God is pretty has a pretty wide range of use in Greek, as it does Hebrew as well. But at this time, the emperor was able to take such praise. Anyone else was not supposed to. If you were given praise like this, you were supposed to deflect it. But we see that in this story that Herod did not deflect this praise. Luke, in his story, he doesn't even take it that far. The people are shouting, "The voice of a divine being, not of a man." And so this was done by a lot of monarchs in the ancient world because they liked to be thought of that way. A lot of the emperors, actually the title, the words "son of God" actually had meaning in the Greek world and even in the Hebrew world regarding the kings and nobility and monarchs and people of high status before it actually was applied to Jesus, because it meant something to them. So this is Herod taking on this type of glory for himself. And what is God's response to this? Josephus says that he collapsed and died 5 days after stomach pains. He died at 54 years old. And it was thought at this time that a bowel disease and having worms like this that were given in the text was an appropriate way for tyrants to come to an end. So here we have a direct response from somebody taking too much glory for themselves. Now, I don't have to probably go too far in our own application for today to see, not only, of course, it's easy to look at those people and the ones who elevate themselves on a grandeur scale, right, and point at them saying, "Well, they're taking too much glory." We can do the same things ourselves. Try to take way too much credit and glory, and what is credited unto us can be credited into God. So it is He who gives good gifts to all. So we come to a summary. The mission is now complete, right? The message, the story writer tells us, the message grew again and more people were added. And now he connects, this is how it's kind of all one segment here, is he connects what happens with Barnabas and Saul back to verse 30 of chapter 11. Barnabas and Saul were finished in Jerusalem, what they had set out to do, and so they headed back to Antioch, which is 400 miles away. So from Jerusalem all the way up north to Antioch, 400-mile trip, not just a short jog. Now, in conclusion, I want to give you a few things that you can take with you, hopefully. The first is that God is not finished with or in this world. We see a lot of tyrants in our day. They take different shape, has different implications, but ultimately it's still about control. These things, while they may go unchecked at times, God is not finished, and He's the one who is going to be the judge. He is, and again, we'll get this when we get to chapter 17, as Paul starts to discourse with these philosophers. But God will eventually right the wrongs and bring justice to the world. And we see that still even today, that sometimes justice comes. But that's not our duty. That's in God's hands. Can we trust God to let that remain in His jurisdiction? And another one is partners with God. And I love the last song that we sang this morning because it brings out this idea of the journey and being involved with God in an intimate way, to where can we be these vessels and be used in God's hand for divine purposes. God is reaching the world, but God does it a lot of times, most of the time, through people. What kind of people are we? Are we the people who are of the party of Christ, who reflect what it was that the Christ taught? Is that the message we are bringing? Is that the type of partners that we are becoming? And so that's nothing. I can't answer that for you. And that's not my duty. That's something for you to look at the story and say, "Wow, this fits with me in an amazing way. I want to be a partner with God like this." Okay? That's for you. That's between you and God. Because he may have something for you to do that's completely different than someone else. And that's what makes the body work. Because we're not all to be doing the same thing. And we have this response to tragedy, even in this story. And I found it so fitting that through many of these stories that we've explored together, week after week, have been really applicable for what has been taking place at the present moment. So this response to tragedy, what are our acts of sacrifice? Again, this may look so different for each one of us. You may be that you're never to step outside of your locale, and that's exactly where God wants you. That's between you and God. Our duty is to be sensitive to what it is the Spirit is saying to us. And then lastly, on the crossroads of culture. Now, as I was thinking about this one, I actually thought it was kind of funny, not in a ha-ha type way, but here we are standing among a group of believers, a community, and you sit literally on a hill, literally at a crossroads. That is a major intersection of commerce and travel. And that's exactly what Israel was to be in what the Gentiles then became through Antioch. They were the intersection of the world. And so, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. This is the message that we find in this story, and that I think that the writer of Acts expects and desires for the people of God and the community of God to see and respond to. And so that, ultimately, is our duty to respond to it. And what will our response be?